Hey, it's Rob. It was an amazing week of Survivor, and we had incredible podcasts with Christian Hubicki and Steven on the Know-It-Alls. Make sure you catch those as well. Plus, The Circle was back this week with an AI contestant. Taryn, Mike Bloom, and Puya broke down the first week of drops from The Circle and on Renap. Who did Sam Moore find for the big guest? Find out on this week's Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast, all right here on RHAP. We know reality TV.
Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Top Chef Wrap Up. I'm Haley Strong. I'm here and I'm having a great time. And I can only imagine things are going to go up from here. Kurt Clark, do you feel the same?
I do. And to quote the original Jurassic Park, hold on to your butts.
Was that a real quote from that movie?
Yeah, I believe that it was Samuel L. Jackson. Like when he was like turning some power back on at some point in the movie.
I think I watched it once when I was young and I was traumatized, so I never watched it again.
I watched it 7 times in the theater.
I'm blown away by that fact.
I just enjoyed it so much that I went back and saw it multiple times with multiple people. It was a joy. Sorry. Anyway,
I'm thrown by this. You know what else I'm thrown by? Our guest today, best friend of the podcast, is back again. Jim, what is this? Like 7 years in a row? 6? Something like that? Welcome, Jim Smith. Chef Jim Smith. Top Chef Charleston.
It's great to be on with y'all. And it probably is 6 years. I guess it's been, Charleston was season 14. And so now this, maybe it's just 4 years. This is 19, right?
So 5 years then. Yeah. 15, yeah, 16, 17, 18, 19. Yeah.
What a thrill. What a thrill to have you back. How have you been? Yeah, what have you been up to? What a year it's been.
Yeah, it has been a crazy year. I know that, you know, I'm still doing the same thing. I say, you know, like I'm still own a restaurant and we are still alive, which is, I think says a lot about the restaurant and what we're doing here. And, you know, the Hummingbird Way opened January 7th of 2020. And so, you know, we really had 2 real months before the pandemic. And since then, we've been doing what every restaurant has been is, you know, to make it work every single day and trying to make cool food and trying to figure out how to keep people happy in weird times. And I'm just in the restaurant a lot. And actually, you know, we're recording on Easter Sunday, which for people who work in the restaurant industry understand that Easter Sunday is a giant brunch day. And it was no different here. It was a crazy day and we survived brunch. And now I'm in an empty restaurant, which is like one of the most calming parts of my day in the restaurant. And nothing's going on. There's no music, no intoxicated yet. Asks no, you know, wondering if the staff is going to show up. So this is a very relaxing part of the day and a very fun time to be in the restaurant.
What are some of the, were there any Easter brunch specials at the Hummingbird Way?
You know, I really stay away from specials. We run our regular menu for brunches. Okay. Well, there are some brunch items added to the menu. Like we do a cool pancake and we do just a simple grits and eggs plate. Lots of our food is brunch friendly anyway as an oyster bar. So like, you know, raw oysters and crab claws and lots of good seafood options. And we almost always have a crab cake. So our regular dinner menu is very brunch friendly itself. So not a whole lot. We did add lamb today, which I was excited about. That was kind of not really a special, but it's something that's definitely seasonal and kind of Easter specific.
Nice. Well, glad that it's still going strong for you. That's awesome. And I know that, yeah. Like, I think when we were, I still remember a couple of years ago, we were like, you know, everyone get out there and get takeout because you can't, you can, you know, it's all curbside, but now you're back and open.
Yeah, we've been open for, I mean, the interior of the restaurant was probably only closed for maybe 4 or 5 months. And we did stop operations for 1 month altogether just to sort of figure out what was going on, sort of when the newness of curbside and delivery wore off. And it was definitely a very questionable time. But, you know, I think we made good choices, you know, and we're still probably one of the only restaurants. I have been going to more and more restaurants and experiencing what's going on, especially in the South. You know, we still do masks for all of employees and we still do social distancing. And so there really aren't many restaurants doing that kind of stuff anymore. I was in Charleston a few weeks ago and went to the sushi bar, which was awesome. Such a great meal. But, you know, the sushi bar has like 10 seats, and there's like three other tables, and like every seat was filled with people. And so it is weird getting out and being in those kind of situations again, but yeah, you know, it's, I hope things are turning in the right direction, you know?
Yeah. So what are you thinking of this season, Top Chef Houston? Are you familiar with the food scene in Houston? Because you're not too far from there.
Yeah, I think Houston is about 5.5 or so hours from Mobile. It's, you know, like New Orleans is kind of like a halfway point, I think, between here and Houston. I have not been to Houston, but I do know chefs from Houston. And I know it's an awesome food scene. It's a big city. It's it's like the fifth largest city in the country or something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's really a huge city. So there's tons of food options and lots of great kind of, there's a really cool scene. And one thing for sure that I really hope that we get into this season, which hasn't happened yet, is Houston is on the coast. And, you know, there has not been a seafood challenge or, you know, any Houston Gulf related challenges. And because there is great seafood in Houston.
Yeah, that's a great point. We haven't seen a whole lot of that. And like, we've seen people cook fish and stuff. And we've had like, last episode we had Joe mention like the shrimp and everything. So yeah, that's a great point. I would love to also see like a nice seafood challenge coming up. But yeah, this was I would say this probably wasn't one of my favorite episodes this season. Again, this season's been so strong that it's like hard to find a low point. But it's always interesting when they make these sponsored challenges for the elimination.
Yeah, I saw in the show description that they were doing a kind of a Nigerian pairing challenge, and that was all I saw in the chat. Like, that's all I saw in the description. So I assumed it was going to be the elimination challenge. I was a little bit surprised to see that be the quick fire, but at the same time, it was nice to see that variety. I thought that was a really interesting challenge. I'm trying to remember, is it Eba or Eba? The swallow, the second one that's made of cassava. I think that's the only one I've ever had. There was when I lived in Chicago, I had ordered dinner from a Nigerian restaurant once just to try it, and it came with that. I didn't know at the time what it was called, a swallow, but it was, it was just it was that lump that you use to swipe up the main dish. So it was pretty tasty.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the swallows, you know, and they are, I'm not, I do know pretty, a decent bit about food from West Africa and sort of African cuisine in general. It's so closely related to Southern cuisine. Mm. And they share tons of flavor, similar, you know, ingredients and flavors and, you know, lots of the same. And Southern food has a lot of the same roots in West African cuisine. But swallows are really cool. And it's a great vehicle for whatever stew you're gonna have. I did think that was awesome when Jay described it as she said it's a lot like those glutinous Korean noodles. You know, they're like, you get a Korean rice noodle dish and you get these sort of big thick fat noodles which are chewy, and you know, it's really similar to those in texture, and the flavor is really mild on all of them. So a great ingredient to work with. I thought this was a cool challenge.
Yep.
I thought it was an awesome challenge. I'm really excited by what they're doing, branching out into other cuisines that aren't often highlighted in food television in general. So that was really exciting. So they had to create a dish to pair with a Nigerian swallow. They had to pull knives for three options. There is Eon, which is pounded yams, Eba, which is cassava, and Amala, which is green plantains. And they kind of had to make something that's based on that. So this was really cool. It was interesting. And I think they were pretty creative with it. Jackson, who has still been on fire, he was at the top with a snapper with tomato sauce and herb salad. Jim, what are you thinking about Jackson's storyline that he can't taste or smell anything?
Yeah, I am a little bit confused because I want to say maybe in like episode 4, he said that his taste was mostly back, but he didn't have his smell, a sense of smell. And then he talked about how smell and taste were related. I'm not really sure. It's wild to me. I mean, you can depend on other people tasting, and you learn how much to season things through muscle memory, but nothing takes the place of actually tasting what your food is, what your food is like. I mean, did y'all, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you might want to say, did y'all have COVID at some point and lose your sense of taste and smell?
Knock on wood, no.
I don't think, I haven't lost my taste or sense of, well, some people say I've never had any taste. but the, I don't believe I've had COVID. I've not felt like the symptoms. So, but so as far as I know, I've not had that, but I've definitely not lost my sense of taste or that would, I would hate it. I think just given the amount I love food.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people who like lose their sense of taste with it. Like just straight up are like, there's like no point in eating. Like you don't want to eat anything. Everything's just like, you have to find something with texture because like you're not getting anything else.
Yeah. I had to lose my sense of taste and smell. It was not for that long. I got it sort of in the Delta wave of COVID. And even though I couldn't taste or smell anything, I could kind of sense if things were salted, if that makes any sense. It was like one of the only sensations I could tell, you know, it was like, and I know that's kind of a weird thing, but it was like one of the only things that I could experience. And, you know, of course, being a chef, you know, I'm super nervous. You're like, will it come back? You know, am I going to lose this forever? You know, what's going on? You know, we closed the restaurant for 14 days because there was, you know, a handful of the staff did. And so it was definitely a weird time. But at the same time, it was, as soon as the taste and smell started coming back, it may have returned more sensitive, or at least the recognition of what those tastes and flavors and seasonings were may have been more obvious to see, or to taste or to experience. And so, yeah, it's, I think that, I don't know. I'm sure he's having a difficult time. I hope he gets his sense of taste and smell back sometime soon. You know, if he's in the finale, there's probably a good chance that there's a break, maybe in that break period, he'll have a chance to bounce it back. You know, there were also other things too, like, you know, people were saying, you know, eat really spicy foods and do things to try to like kickstart your sense of taste. I'm sure there's no science behind any of that kind of stuff, but I was trying anything and everything to make it happen.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, could you tell when things were spicy?
I mean, a little bit. Like, I really could. It was a very strange sensation. Like, you know, you're eating, you know it should taste like things, and you know what it should taste like. You can see what it is you're eating, but at the same time, you know, it's hard to know if your brain is tricking yourself into thinking because you see a bunch of hot chili peppers in there that your mouth should be burning. Mm-hmm. But it was difficult and strange, for sure.
But how long was it before it returned for you?
Really less than a month. I mean, it was maybe like 2.5-3 weeks.
Because when I was in London on vacation a few weeks ago, I went on a walking food tour of the East End. And one of the women on the tour was talking about how she had had COVID and her taste had like left for like 6 months. And I was like, I can't even imagine. So hopefully Jackson's is on the return. Like you said, if he does make it to the finals and there's that gap between the last episode and the final, hopefully it will have returned. And then we were even just talking like last week, I think, about the, you know, there's the occasional quick fire where you have to, you know, blindfold and taste the elements. It's like, I kind of want to see that happen just to see how Jackson does/reacts to it. But I have a feeling, we're not going to see that. So
I am surprised he hasn't disclosed to the other chefs. I mean, maybe he's doing that strategically so they don't like totally mislead him on you know, whether something needs salt or not.
But that doesn't seem like a Top Chef thing to do. Like, it's not like Survivor and Big Brother. Like, it always, especially within the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years of Top Chef, it's really turned into more of like a camaraderie than like a competition.
Yeah, it's the help people plate. Yeah, you know, when people are rushing at the end, it's becoming a little bit more like Bake Off in that sense, where like people will help each other out. I say because I just finished up the season that Sophie won.
Oh, nice!
I think that might have been the first
Noel and Sandy season.
Yeah, and Prue, right?
And Prue spoiled that season, eh?
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Prue accidentally, like a couple hours before it aired, like tweeted something like "Congratulations to Sophie."
So yeah. I'm two in that news. I am, I think, 2 seasons from being caught up. So anyway, yeah, the camaraderie is nice to see. I'm hoping that I didn't reach out to Jackson on Twitter. I said I was going to after last week, but I forgot to. So we'll see if he does, how that transforms. But it was good to see him in the top.
Yeah. Luke made chicken thighs with bitter greens and dried crayfish broth. Buddha, he made shrimp and guinea fowl with peanuts and fried plantains, and he ended up winning this challenge. What have you been thinking about Buddha and Luke's trajectory this season so far?
I think I may have said this the last time I was on this podcast, that like every chef like me wants to have that experience of like working at a place like Noma and really sort of getting there and understanding what's going on. And it is really difficult. I think he said in this episode that he had a good bit of time off between cooking and when Top Chef filmed. And it's got to be, because he is right. You know, people have such high expectations for him because he worked at such a great restaurant. But, you know, like if you look at Noma and sort of understand what their menu, there's like tons of fermented stuff. Things are oftentimes very ingredient specific for a course. You know, it is all a bunch of course. Now, he was a sous chef, which means that he probably had his hands in a whole lot of stuff that was going on. I do think that sometimes when chefs come on Top Chef and they have a really good resume, if they work at some, you know, great New York restaurant, if you are sort of doing like their catering, like you may spend years making one profiterole and you may be awesome at making that profiterole and you may see all of the other amazing stuff that is being made in a restaurant like that. But you're not, a lot of times, if your staff is 100 people, you may just be doing this one very narrow specific thing every day for a long time. And that's how those restaurants are so consistently good, is because those people are trained in the minutiae of those individual dishes. So I think sometimes those chefs have a hard time transferring. I'm not saying that's him at all, because he was a sous chef at Noma and was there for like 8.5 years. But, you know, if Noma, if half of your dishes include something that is fermented that may have been fermenting for a month and a half, that becomes really hard to translate into a dish that you're supposed to, you know, a quick fire challenge where it's, you have 20 minutes to make something. I want to see him do really well. Like, I want him to make one of these spectacular dishes, because what he's making is looking beautiful, but it seems like he's just sort of consistently having this issue with like seasoning or the doneness of the meat or, you know, something that's more technical, which I do feel bad for him like that. You know, Buddha, on the same hand, is in the same kind of situation where he has a awesome resume with all these incredible restaurants, but he's having a much easier job of transferring that to dishes in the competition. There's not a dish that he's made where I haven't been like, oh, I really want to eat that. Like, I want to eat like everything that he's making, and it all looks totally spectacular. So, you know, not to mention that pastry background is clearly really good. He's definitely one of my favorites for the season.
Yeah, he's so interesting. Like, and he's doing really interesting things, and I like what he's doing. I would say I wish he did speak up a little more in this episode in the elimination challenge. I think he could have, I think he maybe could have helped his team out. And I don't know if he was kind of just like, hey, like everyone kind of on their own or whatever, but we'll get there.
Yeah. I will say about that, like if you're on a team of three and you have immunity and the other two don't, if I were him, I would be doing the same thing. I would like, this is their challenge to win or lose. I will make an awesome dish, but I will do whatever they want me to do. You know, like I'm not going to start criticizing them, because then, you know, you don't want them to blame you for making a decision that sends them home. You want to have them be in the driver's seat.
That's an excellent point.
And it looks like, I think, like, to, you know, jumping ahead slightly to the elimination challenge, that looks like exactly what had happened is that, or at the very least, he didn't drag them down into the bottom three. If anything, like he was like, I think, you know, Padma, I think, well, was it just 2 weeks ago where we saw, or last week where we saw Ashley was in the bottom, but she had immunity, and but they still put her in the bottom three. Whereas here they're like, you know, Booty, even if you didn't have immunity, you're fine. You're not going home. You were probably a great dish. Although just thinking of like Luke's never been in the top and has been in the bottom of several times.
Luke was in the top one time, I think.
Maybe it was then the week that I didn't take the notes on the dishes.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it was. So Ashley made a Sukumo wiki with grilled shrimp. Damar made scotch bonnet and shrimp stew with diced pineapple. And Nick made okra stew with chicken thighs and crab. So Damar was in the top, Nick was in the bottom. I was a little worried about Damar in this challenge because he was kind of like, oh, I think I might have gone overboard with the spice. But I I would eat pineapple in truly any dish. So I would probably gravitate towards here, even though the Scotch bonnet would probably murder me.
Yeah, as you say, the Scotch bonnet's on. Is that above or below Carolina Reaper?
I think it's below Carolina Reaper, okay. Reaper, but it's definitely above habanero. Like they are generally
spicy.
Super, super spicy. And if there was a challenge to really like unleash the spice, especially given the judges that are there and the style of food they're cooking, this is going to be the one. You know, you don't really have to worry about Tom like blowing out Tom's palate. You know, Padma is going to embrace the spicy food. I expect that Kwame and what was the other guy's name? Oh yeah, Ope would do the same thing.
Good to see Kwame again.
Yeah, it was great to see Kwame again. And I did look up Ope's restaurant. And I think it's a restaurant. It looks like it may be a delivery service as well, but it looks really great. There's some really cool stuff on it. It's called, what's it called? It's called Chop and Block.
Oh, nice. I like that.
Evelyn made tamarind and chicken wing stew. Joe made chicken and kale stew with suya and banga spice. Jay made poached mackerel and wilted arugula and beef stew.
The sixth spice girl.
Bang of spice. Evelyn out of this group was in the bottom, which is a shame because I love the sound of her chicken wing stew. Like, absolutely sign me up for that. But I think the tamarind was what it kind of took it into too much of a sweet territory.
Even though she's not on my draft team, I just have been looking more and more forward to like Evelyn just winning. But so it was disappointing to see her in the bottom.
She is on my draft team, and I also share the same sentiment.
She's just been crushing it. I didn't mean to interrupt you. She's just
go for it.
She is consistently really good, and they love everything she's making. It's great to see the local talent really, really shine through.
Yeah, and our guest for the quickfire was like, "Hi, Evelyn! Hi!"
Yeah.
She's like,
oh, yeah.
I love it. It's so cute. Joe and Jay were both in the middle for this. Like I said, Budo won this one. He gets immunity for our elimination challenge.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com. For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
And the elimination challenge, boy, is it an interesting one.
Sponsored challenge.
Brought to you by Jurassic World Dominion.
Hey, before we move on, can I talk a little bit about sort of something that's really near and dear to my heart, but that I have sort of issues with and grapple with on a daily basis is that, food from the African diaspora are really amazing to me and really interesting. And the reason why those foodways are so close to Southern foodways is obviously slavery. I said African food and Southern food are really similar, but the reason why is the most terrible reason imaginable. And so people are, captured and forced into slavery and brought over, and they bring their food traditions with them to a new place. And that's part of what makes it, that's what makes Southern food what it is. And really a lot American food has a lot of these kind of traditions from overseas in it. And for me, it's oftentimes hard to grapple with, you know, I cook Southern food, and, you know, not all of my food is Southern. A lot of it's that we use lots of Asian ingredients. I like to use a lot of different ingredients and styles when I'm cooking food. But for me, you know, I would never ever say, you know, what I serve is soul food, or, you know, what I serve, you know, like, really gets me is like, if you see, like, been in the South, they're not from Nashville, for instance, but they open up a Nashville hot chicken restaurant and they totally crush it. They're making tons of money. And it feels to me like there's this real sort of like commodification and, you know, exploitation of food that maybe people isn't related to this. For me, maybe it's just an excuse I make, but, you know, like, when I make collard greens, I'm making the collard greens that, you know, my mother made, and, you know, the sort of the styles of food that I grew up eating, which are Southern food, but which are intimately tied to the horrible traditions of slavery and what brought those foods to the United States anyway. And so, you know, like, I would never say, you know, come and get fried chicken and soul food at my restaurant. But it's important for people to understand, you know, why we had these food traditions and how they ended up getting here. And people like Ashley are doing an amazing job. And Damar, like, I don't know a lot about Damar's restaurant, but he does serve Southern food in Chicago. That's based on, I think a lot of it may be based on his family traditions and sort of experiencing what's going on in the world. And so it's a real fine line. Like, you want to celebrate these foods. At the same time, you want to understand how they ended up in America. You know, as soon as okra is available, as soon as we can get it from local farmers, it'll be on our menu. It's one of my most favorite things to eat. But it's just, it is really important to understand where this food is coming from. And that's why I do think like this are so important, because when these foods, to me, like, when you look at suya, and like, the list of ingredients are things that I work with every day, and I use this combination together very often. You know, you're talking about peanut powder, paprika, smoked paprika, ginger, garlic. You know, these are things that are all very important to Southern cuisine, and they got here in a very specific, terrible way. So it's something that I grapple with, you know, all the time. And, you know, it is about finding the right respect and balance and appreciation, and figuring out the way to do it where you don't feel like dirty for selling food that has, you know, got to America through slavery. So I don't really, it's hard to deal with, but it's something that I think about regularly.
I imagine it's a fine line between celebration and appropriation.
Yeah.
And
no doubt.
And I think it all, and not being a chef, I guess I can't speak to this entirely, but I think, you know, I imagine that, you know, intent and follow through is probably a big element of it, in terms of, like, you know, is there education that's coming along with it in terms of, like, just, you know, informing people, like, this is, you know, this is on my menu, but this is kind of what its roots are. And I imagine then that and this is more of a geographic cultural question. Is Texas considered part of the South?
Yeah, Texas is definitely part of the South, but Texas is for sure its own thing. It's very, I would say that there's a real difference between the Deep South, like, right, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, the Florida Panhandle, Louisiana, and then Texas. You know, Texas starts, right, you're moving westward, but for sure, Houston is way more Deep South than, like, Dallas or Austin are.
And I imagine the impact then that also, even that the, that kind of import of, you know, African traditions in cooking has probably, even though it's impacted, has probably impacted the cooking in Texas in a slightly different way than it's impacted it in say, you know, Alabama or Louisiana. Just making sure that I was understanding correctly.
Sometimes I'll see, like, restaurants that label themselves soul food really have people who probably not be marketing themselves or their restaurant in that way, because it really starts to feel dirty because it's not connected to their individual traditions. It's more of a marketing scheme, and that, mm-hmm, it just feels really icky, you know? Cool.
We appreciate you mentioning that as well, for sure.
The elimination challenge here. Each team must create a 3-course progressive menu that represents a sea, air, and land dinosaur in honor of Jurassic Park Dominion, a movie I will not go see.
Jurassic World, let's get it straight. But we saw the return of Chris and Anna. They've been on Top Chef before. Chris Pratt and Anna Faris.
Yeah, that wasn't Anna. That was
Top Chef.
Yeah. That's we saw the return of Chris Pratt. Yeah. Sans Anna Faris. They are no longer.
That wasn't Anna Faris.
It was Bryce Dallas Howard.
Very much not. I was like, what are you talking about?
Okay, A, I didn't know they weren't together, but B, you're right. It was Bryce Dallas Howard. I completely, upon flashing back, acknowledged that it was Anna Faris, but I did not know they weren't still together.
He's married to Arnold Schwarzenegger's daughter now.
I don't follow this.
Sorry, that's my impact here.
You're 100% correct. That's Bryce Dallas Howard. I recognize her from the movie. I feel stupid now. Let's continue.
I can't wait to not go see this movie. However, I was so excited to see Joe Flam. I love Joe Flam.
He was like, okay, I'll put the stupid hat on. I was a little bit confused about the rules at first because I was like, I wasn't sure. Is there an air team, a land team? And I was like, okay, no. So it's each team is comprised of one of these animals and they can't put the courses into whatever order they want to. There was like a fixed order. So all of the land courses were at the same time or they were the same position in the progressive menu. So it took me a little bit of, to me, this was more confusing than the football challenge with the downs and everything. And they
wanted the menu to be progressive, but it's not like you're tasting the 3 progressive dishes in a row. You're tasting three individually, you know, like three peoples can. It was really strange. It was really strange.
It's like you have the end of one, like you eat one team's first course last, but then you eat a different team's second course first. And you're like, you're not following it. Oh, that would just, that bugs me from an OCD perspective now that you mention it.
Yeah, like, because the first episode of the season, we did have, like, it wasn't necessarily, like, a progressive menu. It was, like, all dishes have to, like, make sense together. And they were all eaten 3 at the same time. Like, I do think they should have presented one menu at a time so that you can see that natural progression. I didn't love the way this was presented, nor did I find that, I didn't really feel like the teams did like super. I just there was progression, but I didn't always feel like the connection.
Well, I think at least the winning team had the, and I don't know if this is like oversimplification, but at least they had the pecan theme all the way through.
That was the only progressive element that we heard about in the show at all, except for them saying it was supposed to be progressive and related to each other in a way.
I just didn't feel like they connected super well. So the red team featuring Buddha, Joe, and Jay, Buddha had the first course, the sea. He made smoked alligator, potato beets, and salmon roe with alligator cream.
Okay, a quick question.
Yes.
I'm
guessing this isn't directed towards me.
No, it's directed towards both of you. I've been to Whole Foods many times and I've never walked out of there with a whole alligator in a bag. So where did he get that protein? Because I don't think he got it at Whole Foods. So Jim, I guess this part is towards Jim. Is there the up? Because I think the chefs are allowed to bring, am I correct in thinking, that an element from home as well? I'm guessing he didn't bring an alligator in a white hefty bag, but do we know where he would have gotten an alligator if not at Whole Foods? Are there other opportunities to source?
I don't think so. What I suspect is they've been going to the same Whole Foods for a little bit, and they probably have a whole alligator on display in their seafood aisle. And I bet that the chefs were all like, somebody's going to get that. You know what I mean? And I suspect that that's what was going on. Or, you know, you can talk to the butchers in Whole Foods and ask them what sort of larger cuts they have. And if the chefs are noticing that they always have alligator, somebody probably just asked, are you butchering the alligator? What parts are available?
It's because I've never been to a Whole Foods that has had alligators as an indigenous species in the area. I will say, like, there's no Whole Foods no alligators in the Whole Foods in Chicago or in Redondo Beach. So, I guess maybe in Florida and the Gulf Coast and Houston, maybe that's a thing. But I was like, I was thrown when I saw him just basically pulling out this whole alligator, like from head to tail. Like, so maybe he's because like, okay, whoever gets immunity next has to take the alligator. Like maybe it was like a dare, but you know, he did get the sea challenge. So, and alligator, I don't even want to know about alligator cream. So I'm just not going to go there.
Yeah. This was another like gorgeous dish by Buddha, and they were obsessed with it. And, you know, I love that Buddha, even though he has immunity, he always tries something different and like doesn't just make a like a cold salad every time he has immunity. Like he actually really throws the ball out there for
it. It's like, again, looking at what Jackson did with his dish, I think all of these dishes could have been, and maybe this is sacrilege, like Rainforest Cafe'd up, like go a little bit tourist trappy, like make this the food that they would serve at Jurassic World / Park. Like he had the alligator head, like do something.
I was expecting him to for sure to see the alligator head in some way on a plate,
or arrange like the teeth around the outside of the plate or something, like something that makes it a little bit more prehistoric. I don't know, but the dish apparently was the highlight of the red team.
Yeah, and it's funny to me that they really wanted the theatrical element of it, because it kind of reminds me of. I guess it was Top Chef Boston when Katsuji went out with the Stephen King dish. Like he went really literal, and maybe it's just because the dish actually wasn't that good, but they were like thrown off by like the bloodiness of it. So I was really surprised to see Tom here being like, "Where's the gore?" I'm like, "Who are we talking about? What is happening, Tom?"
The challenge that was so great that was like this was the one when they did like, I think it was Snow White and the Huntsman. That to me is still one of my favorite ones ever. You know, one of those, I still remember one of those dishes. I don't remember who made it, but it was like a black chicken leg where you know, the claw was still on there, blood on the plate. And I think that they wanted the chefs to go in that direction, but I'm not sure that they were like given the instruction, like we really want you. Dinosaur, you know, getting that instruction, even though that's clearly seemed like what Tom wanted.
Yeah, it would have been nice if they'd steered them in that direction. Maybe they were afraid. Like, I'm even thinking back to the drive-in theater challenge from last season. Like, I mean, I think they were underwhelmed then as well by how non-theatrical and fun the dishes were. I think they were hoping that this would be a little bit more fun than it turned out to be.
Yeah, for sure. Joe made barbecue stuffed quail with Romesco and roasted carrots. She ran into some issues with her kale being overdone and her carrots being boring as heck.
Well, she didn't get to sauce the carrots as much as I think she wanted to. I think that was another issue. It sounded like the time, or I can't remember if it was the time or just the amount of sauce, like didn't cover the carrots. She had some issues with Quetzalcoatlus, the air dinosaur.
I refuse to pronounce any of that.
I noticed you skipped that. I got your back.
I don't have the skill nor the desire. And Joe ended up actually going out with this dish, which was sad to see. We'll eulogize her a bit later. Jay, she made a lamb duo, a spiced rack of lamb and a lamb meatball with pickled Napa cabbage. Now, if you're a fan of Top Chef, I feel like you know that Tom always says, why make two mediocre dishes when you can make one really good dish? And I feel like Jay, her downfall was that she was trying to focus on so many different elements that none of the elements were that good.
Yeah, I feel that way for sure. Like she probably should have done a little bit more homework on this. You know, like if she had left the chop off the plate altogether, just on the meatball, at least it would have been controversial. Like Tom clearly at the end didn't like the meatball, but you heard Joe say that he wasn't sure why he liked the meatball, but he kept going back and eating it because he thinks it's good. And so, and they liked the cabbage. And so she would have just been much better off editing, doing one type of lamb and doing it better.
And I'm thinking like it would have been kind of funny if she'd done goat instead of lamb, only because going back to the very first movie where they
great call.
Thank you. So yeah, I think I just wanted to see more kind of callbacks to the first movie, because that's the only one I remember clearly.
Yeah, I do. I really liked it when Joe referenced the kids eating dish and they flashed it on the screen, because that's definitely a really specific part of them. It's right before the finale, like the kids and the grandfather, what's his name, are eating at the Jurassic Park restaurant. You see this plate of like sliced chicken and fried carrots on top come out, and it was a good callback. I'm glad that's the reason why she put carrots on that dish. At least that's what she said. And so I wish there had been more of that. The goat is a great idea.
It would have been nice if they had been able to screen one of the movies. I don't know if they made maybe not the new, maybe not Jurassic World Dominion, but maybe like even just the original one, just for inspiration or something. I think that would have been kind of a good kind of build on the challenge.
I would have opted out. I would have been like, no, please don't make me do this. I can't watch that movie. It's too scary.
The Triceratops dung. This one was the Stegosaurus.
Scary. I remember it's which all it was. Scary. I don't like scary movies. The green team, they were our middle group. Jamar started off the meal with Duca fried oysters and Fresno chow chow and oyster cream. This looked really cool. I loved what he did with it. I love that he like put the little oyster on top of the chow chow so it stayed out of the broth and it didn't get all like mushy. I love Jamar so much. And now that Monique is gone, his love, he can really focus on Top Chef.
His mind is in the game.
Yeah.
I thought Jamar's dish was awesome. Like that's definitely one of those ones that were on this list of the ones that I would really want to eat. And, you know, it looked beautiful. Caviar cream is awesome. Actually, I ate it in one of Tom's restaurants a few years ago, and he had made an amazing dish with a caviar cream. It looked very similar to the way this one came out at the end. And it's a really cool component and interesting, works really well with the acidity of the chow chow. I like that Kwame described it as the best chow chow he'd ever had. And so this dish just looked to me spectacular.
Was Tom there when you went to his restaurant?
No, or if he was, he didn't come out and say hi or anything. So,
so no, he wasn't. He would have definitely come. Ashley made a shito wing with watermelon relish. Again, this was not one of the favorites of the judges. This is probably their least favorite on the green team. And after Ashley made it back into the competition, I really just wanted her to flourish. I feel like she hasn't quite found her feet yet, which is really disappointing because I like what Ashley adds to the show.
I really like Ashley, and actually I met Ashley at Charleston Wine and Food a few weeks ago. She seemed incredibly nice, like really cool, fun person to hang out with, and I've been rooting for her all season. I just really want her to make it happen. Things just aren't quite firing on all the right cylinders in these challenges for her, and I really hope that she can figure it out before it's too late.
Yeah, and I feel bad because it seems like she's getting discouraged and feeling like she's not as good as her other competitors, when that's not the case. It's just the competition itself. Top Chef doesn't always mean you're the best chef in the entire world. It means you're good at a reality television game show, which involves cooking. But it doesn't always, you know, I've done a big rewatch in the last few months of like all of the seasons, and I think it was Top Chef Colorado where the first woman who went out who was just like, honestly, I just don't think this is my playground. Like Top Chef is just not where I flourish, and that's fine.
I liked how Ash, until you said this, I had forgotten. I was like, so I got the giant flying dinosaur and I'm making wings because I'm creative. And she said it like with that level of enthusiasm. You could tell that she seemed a little bit like deflated coming into this one. Although the watermelon relish I've never had and sounds like it would be quite refreshing. I don't know if that's a kind of a tie back to some of her Appalachian cooking. But at the very least, I would have wanted to try that.
Yeah, no doubt. It looked good. I don't think that she You know, I make some watermelon relish a good bit of time. And I almost always use the like pickle rinds in the relish as well. I'm not sure that there were any rinds pickled in there. It looked mostly like the red part of the meat, but it did look awesome. Like I everything about that dish looked like it was going to eat really well. But as soon as Tom said, "What do you feel about the chicken wing?" I was like, "Oh no, this is the part where, you know, she's going to get in trouble." And you know, it's got to be crazy. You know, those simple, the fundamentals are what always has to happen. You know, and if your fried chicken wing is, well, Tom called it flabby, and I was like, "Oh no, that does not bode well." So
that's like the worst descriptor of chicken, except like undercooked.
Yeah. Raw. You think you could have like arranged it on a plate. So like maybe they're like two wings. So they look like they're spread and you use the relish to make some sort of like
dinosaur
or like something in the claw or something. I don't know. But yeah, that could have been fun.
And then Luke made a Mongolian beef inspired braised short rib and with broccoli, onions, and seaweed broth. This is probably something that I would gravitate towards. Now, what I'm having trouble with this menu is that none of it makes sense together to me. Like, not one part of it connects to another part.
Not at all.
neither really did the first one, thinking about it.
No, like, it didn't. But this really felt very disconnected. Like, I think a Duke of Fried Oyster in the same progressive meal as, like, Mongolian beef inspired dish, like, and like a watermelon relish, like none of that makes any progressive sense to me, except that you're like, well, this is a small one, this is a medium one, this is a big one. Like, it didn't work for me as a progression.
Yeah, I did not even consider that, but you're completely right.
Like, none of it makes sense together. Like, I feel like if they were actually told to make a progressive meal and that was like a component of it, like, the first two should have gotten dinged like hardcore. Like, and I don't feel like they really mentioned that they weren't particularly progressive menus.
Yeah. Really strange. I mean, really, maybe it was just Padma said progressive and they edited that. It's not what they were instructed. You know, it's hard to imagine that the chef testants would just be like, "Oh, well, you know, like, it's about the same dinosaur, you know," or whatever their strategy was for making these dishes. It just seems like they were all individually done.
Yeah, and I wish they got to choose where in the progression their thing went. I think that would have been more interesting, because then we're seeing like a lot of like small seafood bits when I feel like it would have been cool to see like fish as like a second course or something like that. The brown team, I thought, was the easy winners from the sound of their menu. It sounded progressive, and maybe that's just because Jackson went off the board and did a cake. I love that for him. I love that they went dessert. They started off with Nick's crab croquette with pepper puree and pecans. It seemed like the first course from everyone, the first course across the board was their favorite. Nick's was probably their least favorite of the three, but they still really enjoyed it. They just wanted more sauce with this dish.
It sounds amazing.
Sounds to me, this is the menu I would order.
Agreed. I was just thinking your comment about Jackson and the dessert is like it seems at least Jay and Luke interpreted land as this has to be a meat
bison protein or a sort of beef. Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I like that he went off the board with that. And you know, it was like, and not to again play the creative card. Yeah, like his was obvious. Like, they're waiting to see that. Like, with the bloody footprint on there, and Tom's like, "This is what I wanted to see." It's like, it would have been great if somebody had made like something like a dessert where it was like something preserved in amber, like something. I don't know what that would be or how you would make
like
that.
Candied something.
Exactly. Yeah, like, or crumbled amber on top of something. Oh, have fun with this. Go, Jackson.
Yeah. Evelyn made pork tenderloin with black garlic sauce, pecan crumble, and sweet potato puree. This sounds so lovely. Oh, and I love Evelyn, right. So I'm biased towards the dish.
So good. I do want to say that, I don't know if y'all noticed this, but there is like in every episode, garlic. And, you know, black garlic is a good ingredient, but it's a, and in fact, they let you bring, I was like 10 or 12 ingredients from home, and almost every chef brought black garlic, including me. And it's such an intense flavor and it does build umami, but at the same time, it can really wreck your taste buds and overpower anything else that's in a dish. And so I really am surprised. Oh, there's so much black garlic in a lot of these dishes. I think maybe the last episode was the only episode where black garlic wasn't specifically said out loud, but I bet there's a decent chance it was snuck in there somewhere.
I know it's like the en vogue ingredient right now.
The because you're never going to get it. See, that was a, so the very first time I had, sorry, I'll let myself out. The very first time I had black garlic, there's a Korean barbecue place in Koreatown in LA, and their specialty there is they have 8 kinds of marinated pork belly. And one of the, they have a miso one, they have a red wine one, they have a black garlic one. And I had never had black garlic before. And that was one. And I think we got like a flight of 4 kinds of pork belly. And that was one of the ones we got. And I was surprised that it didn't have the same flavor profile as I'm used to from regular old garlic. So it was interesting. So it's something I've been like trying to seek out more because we don't have a lot of it in West Michigan. I'm never going to get it.
Yeah.
Not this time.
You can certainly order it online, and it's really not that hard to make either. It's really pretty easy to make. It's really just a pretty simple fermenting process. It takes some time, but it doesn't take that long or that much effort to make it. But it's a cool ingredient. It's just, I've just been so surprised at how much it's appearing in all these chef's dishes.
Yeah, it seems like every season there's that ingredient that I think it was, I'm trying to remember which season it was, like every dish had carrots. Every not every dish, but at least every episode seemed like 4 or 5 dishes had carrots. I'm trying to remember. I think it was like the most recent California season, but it was like, yeah, definitely black garlic is the one for here. I'm actually Googling black garlic on Amazon. It looks like I can get a hold of quite a bit. So.
There's a farm stand around, not really around the corner for me, but like around the corner enough that sells it. And we've been like dying to stop and buy it, but we're just not sure what to do with it once we have it in our hands.
Yeah. When you get black garlic, taste the tiniest bit of it by itself, and then you will understand sort of the incredible intensity of it. But it's a really good way to, like, you can sneak it into sauces, but the same. Regular garlic can turn a good dish into a disaster if there's too much of it in it. Black garlic is even like that intensified like tenfold. I mean, it can really just overpower a dish very, very quickly. But it's a great ingredient. It's a fun one to use. You know, sometimes Top Chef is like an echo chamber, especially if people are bringing the same things. You know, it was weird. Like the first 3 episodes, there were like 3 different spring rolls from 3 different chefs or, you know, it does seem to me like Luke, lots of nori, lots of kombu, lots of miso. Almost every dish he has is, there's kelp in almost every one of them. It's an awesome way to get good flavors into food, but, you know, you don't want your dishes to all taste like they're based in a similar kind of profile.
Yeah, that's a great point. And then Jackson finishes off this meal with a fudgy cocoa cake with sweet potato, pecan, and raspberry blood. Like we said, it's very visually like the most fitting to the challenge, and Tom was excited to see it. And I think they were just excited to get something like a little different. I love when the Top Chef people would, like, branch out and get a dessert. I need something sweet to end every single meal, even breakfast.
And this one, there was no, unless I was mistaken, there wasn't a single winner. It was like the entire team was one, and the entire team gets to go to the red carpet premiere of Jurassic World, Dominion.
Would you rather go to the world premiere of this or go to the world premiere of Trolls like Gregory won in Top Chef All Stars?
Oh, this.
Come on. Can you imagine?
I forgot about that one. Because didn't they have to make dishes inspired by different types of music?
So what they had to do was Kelly Clarkson came to the kitchen and there was like sections of food that were like certain colors, and they had to like have one food from each color and like make a dish.
I'm sure there was something about like harmonies and composition.
Probably, yeah.
And lots of music related terms.
It was not one of the better ones. What could I say? Yeah. So we see the brown team win this one, and we see the red team being the bottom with Joe going home. Between the green and the red, they were kind of having a hard time, but they kind of decided that Joe and Jay's both were bad enough to sink that team, and Joe's was the worst. I'm sad to see Joe go. I feel like she had more in the tank. I feel like this is one of those situations where it's like one bad week and you're done and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised that she didn't go further. She'd had, I feel like, a series of kind of off weeks. Like, she did fine last week, but I'm just kind of looking back through the notes. She was in the bottom for the brisket challenge, where Ashley had gone home. I thought maybe she was going to go home then, but yeah, it surprised me that she didn't go further, because I think at least from the first few episodes, I think, you know, all of us were thinking she's going to go deep.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I'm sad to see her go, and you know, but maybe she has a chance in Last Chance Kitchen.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Not so much, unfortunately. But she had a chance.
She had a last chance,
yeah,
in the kitchen.
You know, because she went home for the barbecue stuffed quail, they just had to make a dish that featured something stuffed. And she's up against Sarah, who is the reigning champ of LCK. And I have a feeling if she hadn't forgotten to get... Or if she hadn't ended up with Ashley's okra in the second round of the return to Last Chance Kitchen, she may have come back again. But I feel like Ashley's leftover ingredients didn't give her much option. Anyway, I'm replaying the past.
Yeah, I know. Look, I got to say that watching that when Ashley comes back, watching that episode of Last Chance Kitchen, I like... Sometimes the cards just fall in your favor, but that had to be like one of the... I mean, it, just an incredible stroke of luck that, you know, in the 3 minutes that she has to shop, she only picks like four things, and one person forgets salt, and her dish was, you know, obviously, okay, Tom liked those pickled okra seeds. But to me, that you could see her like throw garnish on that at the end. And like, I'm not sure that's exactly what she wanted to make. But then, you know, okay, switch stations. And, you know, what do you leave the other person with? Grits and okra and onions. You know, like she got really lucky on that one. Cause I tend to agree. I think that, you know, if with some more ingredients, it might've had a different outcome.
Well, I mean, at least in this pace, Sarah is doing well in the one-on-one competition. So maybe she's doing well in smaller groups. So let's have her potentially come back in when the competition set is smaller, when it gets down to four or five people. So we'll see how far she advances, but you know,
winning three or four or five in a row to get back in is going to be tough, though, especially as the eliminated chefs continue to
get better and better.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's still in it for now.
Yeah.
So for the stuffed dish, she made a rice dumpling stuffed with odong and wild mushrooms. And Joe made a caponata stuffed delicata squash. And Sarah's came out on top. Udong is a noodle. What is odong?
I think it's an alternate spelling of the same thing. Maybe maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think it is like a glutinous rice noodle. Like they didn't show the interior of that dumpling at all. I was really hoping they would, because I thought she was saying udon, but then like the captions, it was spelled differently than I would normally spell it. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it is noodles. She said it was rice stuffed in rice with the fat, and I think that maybe it's like a Filipino way of like cooking rice noodles in like offal and like tallow and other. I'm not the most sure, but it was. I'm not the most sure.
Because I remember, I think this was the one where she was saying it was like rice stuffed with rice is how she had described it. So I was a little bit concerned because at this point, I'm just rooting to see how far she can go. The Tom preferred the rice stuffed rice to the stuffed delicata squash. It sounded like the squash, like I know that Joe was kind of having it in a couple of different ways, unsure of how it was going to best cook. And I think she ended up going for the option where it was kind of cut like right down the middle, like as opposed to lengthwise. And I think Tom's opinion was that it could have used a little bit more cooking. The squash didn't really eat all that well, but we have Sarah winning again and advancing to the episode 8.
Next episode, Restaurant Wars. Ooh, I'm so scared.
Yeah, I didn't watch the previews, but I just assumed it was going to be Restaurant Wars because we are down to 8. Did the previews confirm that?
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, Restaurant Wars, Tiffany's back, we're restaurant warring. And it was, I'm scared. Restaurant War. Oh, yeah. So it's a little bit of a different setup this season, Kurt. So they're doing kind of the chef's table like they did last season with the judges.
Which I really liked that.
But they're also doing a dinner service at the same time.
Oh.
But the restaurant can still see the chefs.
So it's a little Hell's Kitchen-y in that in Hell's Kitchen, there's sometimes VIP guests in the kitchen with the chefs, but then everybody else in the restaurant can see the chefs also.
That's what's happening.
Huh.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of how I felt too. Like, it's like, I would rather them pick one or the other. I very much loved the setup last year of the chef's table. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we can only wait and see.
We'll see how it goes. I don't know. I can't remember, Jim, if we talked to you about the chef's table experience and last. I can't remember if you were before or after that when we chatted. But what was, do you remember your take on the chef's table setup for
Restaurant Wars?
Thank you, Restaurant Wars. I can't remember the phrase.
Yeah, I really do like that setup, and I think that if they're doing a chef's table while they're doing the rest of the dinner service too, not. Are all the diners going to get the same chefs, like the same progression? I mean, maybe so.
Great question.
But it will be a lot like, it'll be more like a real restaurant service. I mean, we do a tasting menu at my restaurant every day. And so, you know, you never know, like one table is going to have the tasting menu, which is 5 courses. You know, the table next to them is eating like oysters and appetizers or, you know, like, and so it will make it more of a restaurant type experience. And if the judges are in a place where they can see what is going on with how the kitchen is operating while they're in the middle of their tasting menu, it could be really interesting. It would be more like an actual restaurant service that does that kind of a tasting menu option.
I think they're going to get a little bit more of a peek behind the curtain at how smoothly the kitchen is running. If there's a real restaurant
that'd be cool
to serve. And they didn't have servers last year. Like they brought the dishes to the tables themselves, correct? So I think that's always a hiccup at some point. It seems like one team always has some issue with training the servers and then yells at them.
Oh, it's my least favorite part as a former server. It like makes my brain bleed. Like just because of like, They just started this. They probably just hired them off a temp service. They don't know. It's so hard to learn a menu like that. It's so hard. Ugh, it stresses me out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is kind of nice that, I mean, last year there was, you know, there's no emphasis on, you know, if you screw up as the front of the house manager, are you going to go home? Which is obviously important to running a restaurant, but, you know, lots of people don't do that anymore. And so it's not, you don't have to be able to do that to be a good chef. And it does make it more about the food and less about service. But at the same time, that was part of the fun of it all, really. It was watching the chefs try to take care of the dining room at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a feeling the rest of the dining room is going to be able to order off the menu, but not get the tasting experience. Whereas the chef's table probably is going to get a little bit of everything.
That'll be interesting. That's for sure. Well, Jim, what have you been eating this week? What exciting things?
Or making,
yeah. What have you been serving that's delicious? Tell us everything.
Yeah, well, I mentioned the lamb earlier. That's the new dish on the menu, and I really do love it because we are doing a Marcona almond and herb crust on a whole rack of lamb. We have these really tiny little racks of lamb, which are so beautiful, but we're doing a, you know, you get that a great kind of crunchy crust on the outside of it, and we're serving that with some Tunisian couscous, which is awesome. What we have is smaller than Israeli couscous, but bigger than African couscous. It's a really cool couscous, and we're doing a little bit of charred fennel, and we finally got our first squash and zucchini of the year, so we're adding some squash and zucchini in that as well. And that is being served with a tamarind gastrique on there. Lots of mint and dill and fennel fronds on top of that dish. Yesterday was the first day we ran in and got great response from it. Really cool. Currently serve alligator boudin in the restaurant, which is a fun thing. You know, boudin is that Louisiana sausage that's made with lots of innards and rice. And what we're serving has alligator meat in it. And we take it and we make it into balls with, we add some egg and a bunch of extra herbs into the boudin itself, and then wrap it in panko and deep fry it. And then it's served with a salad of like arugula and strawberries and like cane syrup. And so that's a really fun dish that we're serving. Those are a couple of my, well, I really do feel like, you know, first opening the restaurant, it takes some time to get your staff trained to a level where you trust them and like doing more and more complicated and interesting dishes. But now I really do feel the kitchen staff and the front of the house has been here, most of them for the full 2 years that we've been open, where we can really do things like, all right, today, guess what? We're adding this lamb dish to the menu, and I trust them enough to be able to add in ways which make me proud as a chef owner of a restaurant. And it allows us to do more exciting things on a daily basis. So yeah, those are two things that I'm really excited about right now on our menu. It's almost summertime, which means we're, you know, right around the corner from tomatoes and okra and all sorts of peaches and all the great summertime produce. I feel like I've been cooking collard greens. Well, every time it gets to be this time of year, between collards and mustard and turnips, you know, you just feel like, okay, I'm so ready to get out of potato and turnip season and into all of the fresh peas and tomato season of it all. And all of that's coming up right around the corner. So I'm excited.
I don't know if we've talked about this before, but what do you do for your own meals? Like, are you a cook at home kind of guy? Or are you a, I'm going to just get something from another local restaurant or even your own restaurant? Like how does Jim eat?
Well, because of the way in which these past 2 years have worked, most of my meals happen in the restaurant. Just here, I still am here pretty much every day from, you know, 8:30 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night. And, you know, not that that's bad. It's been my dream to own my own restaurant forever. And, you know, that's part of the, especially in the middle of a pandemic, that's what you got to do to make it work. But I spend a lot of time tasting. Honestly, in the morning, one of my favorite things to eat is we almost always have leftover biscuits from the night before. I usually come in the mornings and we'll make a biscuit with some like sunny side up eggs. But then I love to cover it in like just a simple arugula salad with sherry vinaigrette. That's probably what I eat the most during the day, like for breakfast, like right when I first get to work. You know, at home, cooking at home is difficult. Like my wife just got an air fryer, so we play with that some. And I know people really love those things, but I'm not the most sold on it. It's very easy to like, you're like, oh yeah, this is, well, let's just cook pizza in it. And you're like, oh wait, no, why? You know, like it doesn't work as well as you think it should. At home, I try to cook, but there's one thing that I know lots of chefs, and I'm one of them. Like when you cook professionally and you have like real commercial equipment that works really well, like when you go home and like I have an electric range, which is just terrible, and like a crave and the oven, it barely, you know, it's just like a standard kitchen. And you're just like so frustrated. You're like, your counter space is this big and you have little mixing bowls. It just doesn't work as well as, you know, like when I'm cooking, I want like a big mixing bowl and a whip that really whisk stuff with. And so I find it frustrating to cook at home, but I do, we try our best to eat at independent restaurants and support other local businesses that are like us. And that's my favorite thing to do is to cook food that other people eat. I don't really like, I'm always happy to cook for Tracy at home, but I don't like being at home and feeling like I'm at work. And that is something that I think probably most chefs struggle with.
Imagine.
Yeah, I've always totally understood that aspect of it, but I've never even considered like, I am used to good equipment and my oven is shit. Like, I've never like thought about that because you're probably not the only one. That's
it's like,
so
going, it's
funny.
Like, it's like going home and cooking on like easy bake oven equipment. And you're like, like seriously, like I that's how I feel about this air fryer. Like, they're the rage. And like,
I love
that one.
I love my air fryer.
But there are things that you can make really well. And like, I do like the pad you can turn it on and it preheats really quickly versus yeah. like my electric oven. It takes like 30 minutes for it to hit 350 degrees. And you're like, oh God, like in the commercial kitchen, you just turn the switch in like 5 minutes. You're like 425 yeah. if you need to. So I enjoy cooking at home. And if I wasn't like in the kitchen cooking every day, I would probably be more comfortable like cooking at home, but it's not really like that.
Yeah.
I'll have to send you pictures of my electric bacon toaster in action, Jim.
Kurt, what did you eat this week?
I ate a lot of bacon. Cooks bacon in 4 minutes.
You like feed it in the top like a toaster oven?
It's a picture a Foreman grill, but instead of opening up, it folds out like it's like if you have a suitcase, you kind of fold the suitcase to the side.
Yeah.
And then there's like a middle prong in the center, and you drape the bacon over this prong. Or maybe it's better to think of like a vertical waffle iron, okay. but with a metal plate in between the top and bottom layers, so that you drape the bacon over it, you close the two halves up like a suitcase, and then it's kind of so it presses it from multiple angles and then the grease drips down into a little tray. Yeah, it's pretty good, actually. It was a Christmas present.
That's cool. I was kind of imagining, you ever seen those hot dog toasters where you put like the bun on the top?
Yeah.
That's what I was imagining.
You feed it through like a pasta cutter or maker. I'll send you a picture. But no, I had some bacon. I've eaten out a lot this week. I actually have a meal kit coming this week, so maybe I'll have something more exciting to talk about during our next episode. I went out for an early Easter dinner on Saturday evening with my mom, and we were hoping that they would have lamb at the restaurant we went to, but they did not. I ended up having, there were these these Gruyere croquettes that were decent. There was like little choux pastries, but made with like peppered with or sprinkled with Gruyere.
Gruyères.
Yeah, that's what it was. Gruyere. Thank you. They were Gruyere yeah. Gruyères. That's
yeah.
what they were.
Yeah.
Well done, sir. and then the soup was this weird. It was like Fuji apple and tomato bisque with some kale or spinach in there, which it was good. And I got this chicken parmesan salt and bocca sandwich, which was decent.
Salt and bocca means jumps off the plate and into your mouth, I think is the literal translation from Italian there.
I could be wrong,
but I think that's close to it.
It did not do that. and actually, I was surprised. I was only able to eat half of it. I have the other half for lunch tomorrow. And then, but then I also got takeout on for lunch yesterday from a place called Tupelo Honey, which is kind of Southern food. And I got a couple of biscuits. I got sriracha chicken and waffles, and honey dusted chicken with sriracha sauce and waffles, and goat cheese grits. So that was all very tasty. Don't know if I would do the sriracha chicken and waffles again. It wasn't the waffles were a little bit dry, and the chicken was kind of sparse. But
chicken and waffles is not my favorite. Like I know that I understand the infatuation with them, but they're always just either missing something. Like chicken and syrup is great. Waffles and syrup are great. Usually those are two kind of dry things if you're not careful, and then you just make it not dry by adding syrup on it. I don't know. It's just not my favorite thing.
Yeah, I'll have it maybe once a year, and then it takes like a year for me to forget how disenchanted I am by it, and then I'll get it again. So this is my 2022 chicken and waffle moment.
I didn't have like a particularly exciting food week, I'd say. We did break out the barbecue for the first time this year. We're in second full spring up here in Canada. and so it was exciting to do that. We did some roasted carrots out there and then, you know, some chicken. I made marshmallows the other day. I have done that before. I used a different recipe this time. And this time it was much stickier, which made me want to cry while cleaning up. I was very close to having a breakdown when my poor hand mixer had gotten marshmallow up in one of the little, you know, prong holes. And
yeah,
I almost cried. I'm not going to lie to you. I got a screwdriver and like tried to stick it in there and like, you know, whatever. My favorite thing I ate this week though, I went to my first Blue Jays game since like April of 2019. Oh. Ooh. And I had a Schneider's footlong. Damn. Those things hold up. Oh, it was so good. It was perfection. It was the best hot dog I've ever eaten. And it was a thrill.
Nice. I have been experimenting, like, and I apologize if I talked about this in a previous episode, Haley, with luster dust.
You have not been talking about luster dust. I would remember that.
Jim, you know luster dust?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like very fine food grade edible glitter. And I think I might have sent you the video of the drink that was all shimmery and swirly.
Okay, that sounds familiar.
Yeah,
that's what we did. We did a luster dust cocktail in the restaurant a few months ago for sure.
And it's that gets everywhere if you're not careful. And if anybody is familiar with hypnotic liqueur, then it's the thing that makes it all shimmery and swirly. But yeah, it's I got like an 8-pack of small little luster dust containers, each a different color, because I did not realize until I bought it that you kind of have to color match. Like you can't just
Or else it'll turn out brown.
No, that was a rum and coke. Okay. It was supposed to be brown. No, but the thing is, if you want like the rum and coke to be you know, shimmery, you have to put the brown luster dust in there. Like that was one of the colors that came. Right. So you can't just put orange luster dust into but I'm just going to keep saying luster dust because it's fun. You can't put the orange dust into just water and expect a shimmery drink. You kind of have to color match.
Put it in orange juice.
Which I did. I put it in peach juice this morning just to see the effect. So that's been something I've been just kind of playing around with, trying to get the right measurements. But yeah, and I got a new coffee maker also. So yeah, just random. I don't know. I've not tried making shimmery coffee. I don't know if that would go well.
Maybe don't. I would say maybe advise. I'd personally advise against that one, maybe, but I don't know. Jim, where can people find you on the internet if you want to be found on the internet and or at your restaurant in person?
Oh, hey, wait. Can I do something real quick?
Please.
When I was listening to the first episode of y'all doing Top Chef, the recaps this season, y'all were making this joke about sirloin. Y'all remember that?
Oh, the knighted. Like there's regular loin. Uh-oh. Jim is walking away from his we're talking about what the difference between loin and sirloin was. We thought one was just knighted. But Jim has walked away from the camera. It's like beckons. Oh no, what's he got? He's coming back to the camera.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. You're good.
I have this hanging in my restaurant and there's no doors to the kitchen, so it's hanging in a place where I can see if somebody walks by and reads this. And for 2 years, I have fully expected somebody to walk by this and laugh. And, you know, like, I'm going to do something nice for them when somebody walks by and laughs and says, oh, I get that. But this is, when I saw this online, I was like, oh, I've got to have that for the restaurant. People will think that's great. And so this is a real clipping from the Illustrated London News from 1854. And it is Charles II. Knighting a loin of beef. And so, you know, it is an actual I dub the sirloin joke. I will take a picture of this and send it to you.
Please do.
And nobody has walked by the restaurant and even looked at it or laughed. It's hanging.
So amazing.
It's hanging at eye level and it's the spot where everyone, you don't have to walk by it, but if you go to the back of the restaurant or to the restrooms, you pass this. And like literally in 2 years and tons of guests, no one has ever walked by and said, okay, that is hilarious. But you know, so this is, you know, a real clipping from the Illustrated London News from, you know, 1854.
And it's not like the rest of the Hummingbird Way is decorated with clippings from the London Illustrated. Like this kind of stands out as unique. And yes, nobody has enjoyed the humor of a knighting of a piece of meat.
Beef puns, incredibly underappreciated around here.
That does feel like our shtick, though, beef puns.
Yes.
Food puns in general is quite up our alley. Where can people find this in real life? Like, where can people come see?
Oh, yes. The Hummingbird Way is located in Mobile, Alabama. We are in the Oakley Historic District. You know, this restaurant has been either a grocery store or a restaurant since 1940, and it has an attached building to it, which will be a wine cellar and private dining room soon, which was built in 1870. So it is a very historic building right in the heart of downtown Mobile, Alabama. We serve tons of good stuff, you know, and we get a lot of tourists here. You know, the cruise ships dock here. We're the birthplace of Mardi Gras in America. We were the original French capital of the United States. So there's that sort of deep old school French history here. And in fact, the French lost the French and Indian War and then relocated to New Orleans from Mobile. And so it is a real cool old port city in Mobile. Oh, that actually reminds me. One more quick story is that a guest booked a reservation online, and he wrote in the reservation note that he heard me on a podcast and wanted to come and eat at the restaurant. And so when he came in, I made sure to ask, you know, I do a handful of podcasts and some kind of regularly. And I said, so you know, where did you hear it? Which podcast did you listen to? And he said, I'm a giant fan of RHAP. I love listening. You know, and I said, oh, that is freaking awesome. Me too. And we were so swamped. I didn't really have to him. I felt really bad about it. But, you know, it was really great to hear somebody say, I listen to RHAP and your podcast on the show, and that's why I'm at your restaurant. And so those things are important and meaningful, and I enjoy talking to y'all, and it's good to know that somebody else out there enjoys listening to me babble about sirloin and food and stuff. But I'm very easy to like, friend, and follow on social media. I am pretty good about responding to requests. I have made it my mission over the next several months to be way more active on social media. So it for me, it's all of my Chef Jim Smith, and the restaurant's name is at the Hummingbird Way. And so it's very easy to find me on social media. So please reach out, follow, ask questions. Like I say, I'm usually pretty good. If you DM my Instagram or whatever, I'm a pretty good responder, even if I haven't posted anything in a week.
I actually saw a Reddit thread this week that was like, I'm rewatching like Top Chef Charleston and I love Chef Jim. And like a couple of the comments, like every comment was like, I love Chef Jim. And then one of them was like, sometimes he'll go on the RHAP podcast. And I like messaged, I was like, he's coming on this week, actually. So yeah, I'm so thrilled to hear that at least one person has like made the jump over from the RHAP podcast, the Hummingbird Way. You know, hey, listeners, if you go there, let us know. Take pictures, send them to us, please. Please, please, please.
Hey, I have to say one more thing that's RHAP related. I, for years, have not watched any of the international survivors because I knew they were going to come to America sometime. And as soon as they hit Paramount, I was like, yes. It was right before season 42 started. I was like, I'm going to start marathoning all this Australian Survivor.
How far did you get before they yanked it?
I made it through two seasons, which I absolutely loved. I mean, I don't know when I've been there so much as I enjoyed watching these Australians heartbroken when they took it away. I was like, I thought something was wrong. I kept I deleted the app and reloaded it. And I was like, wait, where did it go? Like, why is it not on here anymore? And so, you know, Paramount Plus, you know, bring back my international survivor. So.
I remember that Sandra was like heavily pushing Paramount Plus because her season was going to be on there. And then they yanked it like one episode in.
So painful.
Oh,
Kurt, where do people?
All right, well, that's all the random rantings I have that are unrelated to Top Chef. So
it's all good. It's all good.
Thank you all so much for having me back on. It's been a pleasure as always.
You know we love having you on.
Yeah, we do. We do, definitely do. If you want to follow me, I am at Kurt Clark with two C's. Follow me on Instagram if you want to see what I'm eating. Follow me on Untappd if you want to see what I'm drinking. Follow me on Twitter if you want to see what I'm tweeting. If you find me on OnlyFans, let me know because that's not me. Other than that, yeah.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @hstrong_. You can check out what I'm reading on my Bookstagram at The Strong Library. If you want to listen to more of my voice, I joined Tori and my Bachelor co-host, Amy, on the Ready to Be Petty podcast this week. And that was a lot of fun if you like pop culture and general Bachelor news. So that was a fun one. Until next time, pack your knives and head on out. Bye.
Bye.